And it's like we get a signal that there is a pain a-coming in the heart of the Father. Would you thank our drama team as they take their lead from the platform? I was in a meeting a week or two ago with some senior leaders of our denomination here in the city. And as we talked about what we would dream our denomination to look like here in Sydney in the year 2030, when my grandchildren start to hit mid-teenage years, God willing. What would our denomination look like? What would it be known for? And as we talked, a leading world-class theologian amongst us said, you know, in the year 2030, I would hope that we are known for our ability to love people as well as defend the truth. Because, you know, the reality is we are known around the world as defenders of the truth, but we're not known for how we love. Now, at that point, two things went through my head. I couldn't believe what I was hearing from whom, and almost wanted to go, yes, finally, these guys are realizing that the defense of the truth, though important though it is, we're not really learning how to love. And so he said, we should learn how to love. In fact, we should disciple people in that, because so far we're failing as a denomination. And then another part of me was caught up in, man, we're talking about this right now at church. We're talking about the people who are to gather around Jesus and what they're like. You remember last week we started looking at the people who gathered around. There were the sinners and tax collectors who seemed to be taking the front row. And these were people who were far from God in their sin. And then off to the side, almost out of camera shot, were the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And we learned last week that these men were far from God in their goodness. And as we think about these two groups of people, we're meant to ask, well, where are we in the platform? Where are we? For there's a very real danger in the church that we can end up being far from God in our desire to be good. And the question is made all the more acute when we pause and reflect. You know, the people who gathered around Jesus to be with him, they tend not to be the people who gather at churches nowadays. Now, why is that? Is it that we've become defenders of the truth to such a point? Is it that we've become so interested in being good that what we've actually done is walked away from Jesus? We've become older brothers. The trouble with older brothers is they don't know that they are older brothers. All they know is that God is kind of distant, that coming to church and being a Christian is a bit of a drudgery, and their faith is lukewarm. And so Jesus speaks to these Pharisees and teachers of the law, these older brothers, and he speaks to them a parable, which he now continues in verse 11 of Luke 15. So if you've got your sermon notes there, this is a good time to take them out, make some notes. We're picking up this whole thing in verse 11 of chapter 15, where Jesus continues. We're told, there was a man who had two sons. Now, I've got to tell you, this is a shocking story at almost every turn. And it begins in verse 12, the shock. The younger one said to the father, Father, give me my share of the inheritance. Now, this is a young upstart. This is the sort of guy we see on A Current Affair from time to time who turn up and the cameras catch up with them because they have no money, but they've worked out how to get it out of a rich relative. Well, here's the young son. He's got no money of his own, but he's worked out how to get it out of his father, who is a prominent landowner, it seems. And so he asks for the inheritance. In his day, that would have been a third of the inheritance. The older brother would have got two-thirds. He gets a third. So he says, you know, Dad, give it to me. Really what he's saying is, I'm wishing the old man would drop dead because I want the money now. I want what he has to offer. I don't want a thing to do with him. So, cough up, Dad. It's such an outrageous request that the audience listening to Jesus would be thinking, particularly the Pharisees and the tax collectors, Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they would be thinking, that boy needs to be taken outside and shown a thing or two. He needs a beating. And the father would not just simply be forgiven it to him for this insolence, but he would be applauded. Because this boy he's showing no respect at all for his father. But the father in the parable doesn't take him outside and beat him. Rather, what he does is he divides the property. He endures the agonizing pain of rejected love and then divides the property between his boys. An interesting thing about the word for property here in the ancient language is the same word from which we get our word biology. It's the word to do with life. And so the father is dividing his life. If you've had anything to do with country people, and if you yourself have lived on a property or you know someone who's lived on a property, you know that property means life. It's lifeblood. Often properties are in families for generations and generations and generations. This is where life is. A man of the land is a man of the land. The land is part of him. To divide his land up is to divide his life up, even in Australia. And yet this father divides his life between his boys, and the shockwave continues. Now the boy has a third of the property, still no cash. He has dreams, he has plans. And so what he does is he sells the property. But because he knows what he's done is odious, he sells the property cheaply at a fire sale so that he can get the cash and take off. That's the only explanation we can have for what we read in verse 13, where it says, not long after that. Property sales don't happen instantly, but at a fire sale, they go really quickly. So, not long after this, the younger brother gets all he has, sets off for a distant country, squanders all his wealth in wild living. So what he's done here is he sold the property out from under his father's feet while his father's still standing on the property. He has no respect. No respect for his father. And when we get to verse 14, we're told, after he spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country and he began to be in need. I used to think the word prodigal was this son, a sinner, a wayward sinner. You know, the picture of a guy who would end up at King's Cross spending all of his money in bar after bar, woman after woman. That's what I thought prodigal meant. But the word actually means extravagant. This son had been living the high life. He'd been living extravagantly in the far country. And after he'd been so extravagant that his money's running out, as his money's running out, a severe famine starts to take a hold in the land in which he is now living. And when he's run out of money, the severe famine bites in. He's in desperate straits. He has no money. He has no family support. There are no unemployment benefits. He's in a foreign land. And while he's walked all over his father, he still has enough pride to want to be independent, and so he doesn't go home. And so we read in verse 15, so he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to the fields to work with pigs. Now, this is a Jewish boy. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. Can you see the picture? This is a Jewish young man, the son of a prominent wealthy man who has lived so extravagantly that he is now penniless, and he ends up not only feeding the pigs, but the sense is that he is wishing that his stomach was capable of digesting the stuff the pigs were eating because he's hungry and the pigs are not. This is a Jewish boy who is now wishing that he was a pig. And then we read, verse 17, when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here am I starving to death? Now, friends, we need to walk across this slowly. This is not a statement of repentance here. This is a young man who is hungry. See what he says? How many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and I'm starving to death? Like all young men who, from time to time, a young man's stomach becomes his guide. That's right, isn't it? Those of you with boys who are becoming teenagers, they all of a sudden become a plague of locusts on their own in your house. So in my house, sometimes what appears is freshly baked biscuits. And they sit on a wire thing, And that smells so nice. The aroma wafts through the house, and I think, oh, I'll have one of those. And when I blink, two plagues consume all of the biscuits in my house. Just like that. All gone in a blink of an eye. I was never like that when I was their age. And neither were any of the men in this congregation this morning ever like that. But today's young men are like this. They get hungry, you eat. So this young guy, he's in a pigsty, he's hungry. He wants food. He says, I've come to my senses. I know where I can get food. Back home. So he says now in verse 18, I'll go back home and say to my father, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. He's trying to dress it up a little here. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. So make me like one of your hired men. Put me on the payroll so I can buy food. And I might just be able to pay back some of the inheritance that I've spent when I was being rather extravagant in a far land. His aim is to work off any debt that he thinks he might have. He's not coming home to repair a relationship. He's not coming home to restore a broken heart, to heal that. He has the assumption that you can pay, you pay off the debt. And any assumption that says you can pay to compensate a rejected love is just simply grotesque. It cheapens the pain. But still, he's hungry, and so he goes home. Now, here's another shock. Verse 20. He gets up and he goes, and while he's still a long way off, his father saw him and is filled with compassion for him. He runs to the son, throws his arms around him, and kisses him. And we may look at this and say, well, what else would you do? Is that not what a father would do? Well, we need to see through Middle Eastern eyes for a moment, and cultures not like ours for a moment. This young boy, you recall, caused great deep pain to his father by asking for the inheritance. Drop dead, give me the money. And that had ramifications for the village they're in, because the young boy cast shame not just on the father, but on the whole village. And so the whole village now wants his guts for garters. He is a shame-filled young man. Who would have him come back into the fold? He has caused us embarrassment. He has run our name through the mud. He has run that man's name through the mud. And so the first thing that they would see him would be to start the accusations and bring recrimination. And the father knows that. The expected response from a stern father in the first century would be to either ignore him or say, I told you so, or give him a whipping, because he had been out of line. But here comes the shock. The father runs to the son. No one runs in the New Testament, really. There are 12 instances of running, and it's all younger people or for other reasons. The only prominent person who runs in the New Testament is this man. Running is not doesn't go together with older men, with prominent men. To run in the Middle East, even today, you've got to hitch up your robes. You've got to pull your robes up so you've got freedom to move. But to do that, you'll bare your legs, which have not seen the sun for a while, and so they're not as dark as the rest of you. It's a little bit like in our world, where if you see older men who've worked in the business world for all of their life and they hitch their trouser leg up a little bit, what you see is not a tanned leg. It's milky white. And you think, who'd own those? Well, he does. And would you hitch them up and run? Well, you know, I'm not so sure. In the Middle East, you don't hitch your legs, your robes up to run. It's just not the done thing. It exposes your legs, which is to expose your shame, because we get an indication in Isaiah that if you do that, people would see your nakedness. Let the reader understand. You can work that out yourself. So he hitches up his robes and he runs. He is prepared to experience public shame in order to get to his son. And when he gets to his son, he puts his arms around him and kisses him, which is the very thing the son should have done when he came home. But not kiss him on the neck, possibly kiss him on the hand, but because the son had been such a jerk, he should have been kissing his father's feet. But the father kisses the son as if he was welcoming an honored guest back home. The whole village would have seen this. And everyone listening to this would have been in shock. Tax collectors and sinners, Pharisees and teachers of the law, the villagers, and the son in the story. They're all in shock. Jesus is saying, men, you are right to say I eat with sinners and tax collectors. And I have not just let them eat with me, but like the shepherd and the woman and the father running through the village, I am willing to pay any price to set them free so that they can sit at my table. And we know that by words of another verse from Romans 5:8. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So dumbfounded is the son, he can barely speak. All he can do is say the words he'd rehearsed, but now they have a different weight. And he doesn't say all the words, just the first sentence, where he says in verse 21, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. I am not worthy to be called your son. There is no thought any longer of him working off his debt. There's no need. He's been fully reconciled to his father. There is no thought of the father interrupting the speech when we get to verse 22, for there's nothing to interrupt. The boy's heart has been completely changed, and now we are seeing evidence of repentance. For like the sheep, the boy has been found, and his heart has been changed. It has been profoundly softened by the father's grace. The but of verse 22 tells us the father knows this son is not worthy, but we're going to celebrate anyway, he says in verse 22. You have a look at that here. Quick, bring the best robe. That would be my robe. Bring my robe. Put that on him and put a ring on his finger, the signet ring, the family signet ring, to say that he's got authority again. And put sandals on his feet. For crying out loud, he's a free man. Put sandals on his feet. And then bring the fattened calf. Don't bring the little sheep, the little lamb now. No, no, no. We want a feast. No lamb. No sheep. No, not big enough. No goat. Not big enough. Bring the fattened calf because we're going to celebrate. In fact, invite the whole village along. The whole village can come and celebrate with us. Do you remember last week we talked about the Pharisees who called themselves associates when they gathered together? Remember that? Well, the father here is going to invite the village. He's inviting his associates to come and celebrate with him. Bring the whole village in, he says. Let us celebrate, for my son, which was lost, is now found. He was dead and is now alive. Can you hear the father's heart? Though significantly pierced by rejected love, though humiliated and walked all over by his son, he says to this son, and to the sinners and tax collectors gathered around him, no matter what you've done, no matter what you've become, there's a place to call home. There's a place to call home. These are words that a man longs to hear. These are words that a woman's heart aches to hear. These are words of welcome, of embrace, and inclusion. And that's a story that has been repeated countless millions of times for the last 2,000 years. It was repeated 36 years ago when a 15-year-old boy heard the call of the Father to come. It was repeated in your life when the Father said, come. And that's why we like Luke 15, isn't it? No recriminations, no accusations, no I told you so, but simply no matter what you've done, no matter what you've become, there's a place to call home, so come. And I've no doubt that the sinners and tax collectors around Jesus were caught in a bit of wonder at that point. Can't you see that? Like, they were feasting with Jesus. Jesus is feasting with them. And I can't help but wonder if in a moment they had a collective catch of breath and their hearts stopped all at once. Is it possible that the Heavenly Father is like this Father in the story? To which Jesus would say, with absolute grace, yes. If you're in our building this morning and you've not yet tasted that grace, then Jesus' arms are still open and he says, come. Come. Keith and I would love to talk to you. Anyone in the band would love to talk to you about that. And we'd catch up with you afterwards and help sort that out. But Jesus hasn't finished his story yet. There were two sons, he tells us. in this story. And we're about to meet the second one. We haven't heard from him, which is a little mystery, really. Everyone's thinking, where's the older son? Jesus hasn't let him come in yet, and now we see him. He's walking in from the fields. And we get to verse 26, where the older son comes in, and he hears music from afar and dancing. And so he calls one of the servants and asks him, what's going on? Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. Now, at this point, everyone listening to Jesus expects the older son to run in and start celebrating. His younger brother's come home. Come and celebrate. Honor the father. But there is a shockwave yet. Again, verse 28, where we read, the older brother became angry and he refused to go in. And the father goes out and begins to plead with him. Now, what does that do to the father? Well, whatever it does, it gets worse. Verse 29. The son says to the father, now notice how he addresses him. It's not like, hey, dad, come on. There's no father in this. There's none of that. It's just straight to the point. Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But here this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home and you kill the fattened calf for him. Now, it's not too hard to imagine at this point that we have a St. George Bank TV commercial at this point. You know, where there's the old commercial, someone says, I'm a banker, and everything goes quiet. It's not too hard to imagine that as the father goes out, because people might have seen the son standing outside, arms folded, steaming up out of his ears and nose and stuff. Father goes out and he's pleading with him for the banquet to fall silent as they watch what unfolds. All the camera action is on the father and the older son. And it's interesting, we don't know really about the younger son spending money on prostitutes. We don't really get an indication of that until the older brother speaks, which is fascinating because the older brother never went to the far land in the story to see how the younger son was getting on, where he was spending his money. He never did that. He's just put two and two together and come up with 50. There's a story from the 5th century, a monk called Vitalis. Vitalis was in a small monastery area doing a life of solitude until he read John 8, the story of the woman caught in adultery before Jesus. And as he read that, he felt compelled to leave the monastery in Gaza and go to Alexandria to work amongst prostitutes. And so he went to Alexandria and got himself a labourer's job where he'd work during the day and then take his wages and go to a brothel and get a prostitute. Now, he'd made a list of all the harlots in Alexandria and began to minister to them one by one. He would spend all day working, take his wages at the end of the day to a brothel and get himself a prostitute, and he would say, I will give you this money on the condition that you leave your life of sin. He would spend the night with her, pleading with her, praying for her, praying something like, Jesus, thank you for creating us. I pray for this little one, that you might protect her from evil this night. And he would plead the whole night with them, and in the morning he would leave. Word got out that a monk was spending time with prostitutes in Alexandria. On a building site one day, one of the other builders caught Vitalis and said, you filthy old monk, if you can't control your desires, get married and stop blaspheming the name of Christ. And Vitalis would still do his work, go to the brothels, get himself a prostitute, give her the money, begging her to leave her life, praying for her. He left one woman's room one morning, a winter morning, snow had been falling, and a young guy caught him and cracked him across the face, really laid one on him, and said, Vitalis, you filthy monk, go away from here, leave this, because you dishonor the name of Christ. And Vitalis stumbled off, bleeding profusely. The young prostitute said, what have you done, you pig? He said, well, this prostitute, I've taught an old monk a lesson long overdue. And she said, he's not like that, you idiot. He spent all night praying for me and begging me to give up my life, and I will. The young man was cut to the heart, so he started running throughout Alexandria saying, Vitalis is innocent, Vitalis is innocent. And so the town came out looking for Vitalis. And when they finally found him on the outskirts of the town, he was kneeling in the snow, frozen in death. Next to him were the words of 1 Corinthians 4:4, which call upon us not to judge things that we don't fully understand, because they will be revealed on the last day. History tells us that at his funeral, the number of women present was just astounding. Some were married, some were nuns, but they had one thing in common. They were once prostitutes. And they said, Vitalis begged us to leave our lives, while all Alexandria left us alone in our misery. It's easy for a self-righteous person to put two and two together and come up with 50, like the older brother did in this parable. Why is he like this? Well, he knows the Old Testament about the Bible calling upon sons like ones who spend time with prostitutes to be put to death. The older brother knows this. And that's a very serious allegation, because if the older brother's allegation has proven true, then no one in the village will ever give his daughter to that younger son in marriage. The older brother wants to destroy the younger brother in the eyes of the father, even though the father has already received him. Self-righteous spirit can poison a man, can't it? And now all eyes are on the father. This is the second son and the eldest son to have walked all over the father now. The younger brother's actions were carried out in relative privacy, but this one, it's on the outskirts of a banquet now. Everybody knows this. It's like the older brother standing up before everyone and saying, my father's a fool, he's an idiot. Can you see what he's done? But again, there's a shock for us in verse 31, where the father now says, very tenderly, my son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. Everything. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He's been found. Jesus is saying to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you're right to point out that I eat with sinners and tax collectors. You're right to do that. But I have to eat with them, you see. I seek not only them, but I also seek you. Will you come? If you're offended that I have table fellowship with sinners and tax collectors, do you not understand, my dear friends, that if I do not eat with sinners, then I cannot eat with you? And then the story stops. Jesus doesn't finish the story, it just stops. Camera's on the older brother. How will he end the story? What will happen? The banquet is still, the musicians are silent, the dancers are waiting, the servants are waiting to bring out the food, children are motionless, dogs are quiet. The camera is on the older brother. And as we look at that, we see that the image of the older brother changes, it morphs, and you see yourself in the camera shot. We are on the stage, and we must finish the drama, and all heaven is holding its breath. What are the associates going to do? Will the older brothers, will the churches let grace so soften their hearts that they find their place at the Father's table?